This is Car Expert.
First time in almost 3 years that there have been more cars sold in a month than the corresponding month in the previous year.
I'm shopping a GV80 against a Porsche Cayenne, if that even makes sense, because nothing else in that category interests me.
It's small-mindedness to say that you would tax that well and truly before the thing's even got its fingers on the ledge here in Australia. It doesn't make sense.
Hello, my name is Mandy Turner, and this week I am joined by Albors Feller.
Hey, Mandy.
And Mike Costello, hello.
Hey, Mandy.
Now, actually, Mike, you're sitting in a car at the moment, not at your desk, your typical podcasting desk. What are you sitting at the moment?
The joy of remote technology. We've got these great microphones and things now that we can take with us. Yeah, it's been one of those weeks, Mandy, where we're all running around trying to finish things off before the end of the year. I'm actually sitting in a Toyota Yaris Hybrid at the moment. So a super capacious machine in which to record a pod. Yeah, pretty nice. Bit overpriced,
nice. Bit overpriced
for what you get, but pretty nice thing nevertheless.
Which one have you got?
I've got the mid-range hybrid, and I've literally just picked it up then, so I'm not across all the facts and figures, but I believe it's nudging 30K on the road. So this isn't the top of the tree one. This is the middle of the road. So, yeah.
So much money for a Yaris. Hey, it's crazy.
It is a little bit. I guess the proof will be in the pudding in time, whether punters are willing to spend it or not. But there's no surprise that the likes of the MG3 are dominating the sales charts these days when they're so cheap.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Yaris, last week we did talk to Paul Marrick about his drive in the GR Yaris, a non-press car. But, boys, you got a chance to drive it this week. I'd be keen to get your thoughts on it. What did you think of it?
Yeah. I went to Canberra with Toyota to drive the car. And, look, I'm really confused about that car. Now, I say this because I also just put an order for one in, but I bought the Rally version, the GR Yaris Rally, which is the one with all the tricky diffs and stuff. But this would have to go down as the most strangest car launch that I've ever been involved with, where a car company has sold 1,000 other cars for a different price to what it will then go and sell them to other people. And we're talking 20% difference in the price. It's a huge deal because a lot of people, or 1,000 people, bought it at 40 grand and another 100 people bought it at 45 grand. And the normal price is 50,000. And I just don't understand the logic. I get that they put support behind the car for that first 1,000, but how would that make anybody else wanting to buy the car feel? Like, you know, are people just willing to pay an extra 10 grand for the exact same thing that somebody else paid 40 grand for 2 weeks ago? Like, you know, we talked about the new car prices being fixed because people hate getting ripped off. Well, I feel like they're now being fixed and feel like I'm getting ripped off. You know what I mean? Like, there's a strange element with this launch strategy that I still haven't worked out, but the car itself is amazing. If you can ignore the fact that you got to pay an extra 10 grand for it now, the GR Yaris is the only thing wrong with the GR Yaris, in my opinion, is the name. It has nothing to do with a Yaris. It doesn't share anything with a Yaris except the four panels. I think the four parts, the headlights, the taillights, the antenna fin on the back, and some other thing that's just irrelevant. The rest of the car is a Frankenstein of a Yaris and Corolla platform with all unique bits and things like that. The only reason it's called a Yaris is to meet homologation for the rally stuff. So, yeah, you're really getting a different car. You're really not getting a Yaris. Unfortunately, it's called a Yaris, and that's why it's hard to swallow the pill for the price that they're asking for.
Why did you decide to buy the Rally?
Honestly, I should have just bought the normal one, if I'm perfectly honest with you, at the $40,000, because that's a bargain. Like, 40 grand for that car. Any one of those 1,000 people that bought one are going to be able to hold on to that for 2 years and probably get their money back or lose very little on it. So that's a great choice there. I was holding out. I like to just buy the thing with all the stuff on it. There's no real logic to that. I was talking to Neil Bates, who runs the Toyota Rally team, and he's also bought the Rally. And I said to him, you know, the tricky diffs make a difference. And he said, for 99.9% of the time, you can't tell the difference. And I was like, well, I'm really glad I paid the extra 10 grand. or in my case, the extra 20 grand. So 50% more expensive for a couple of diffs. Look, I bought one because I used to own a WRX and you know, a very hotted up WRX. And this, getting in that car and driving it rapidly around track and also around some really nice roads in Canberra, it reminded me of that. And that brought back some really happy memories. In fact, it's a much better car than my WRX ever was, but it had that same fundamental all-wheel drive sort of, you know, a little car that just wants to go really hard. And yeah, it's great. It's fantastic. And to get all that from a three-cylinder engine is ridiculous. So yeah. 200 kilowatts from that is just insane.
It's going to look good but sitting between your Aston and the Ferrari in the garage.
Yeah, it will. I think I want to do Targa in it. That's one of the reasons
I bought it.
Yeah, so I'm considering selling the Lotus and using that as a Targa car. So that might be what it ends up being used for. But I also just love the idea that Toyota has made it. I love an idea that the company, you know, could have done so many different things, could have made another boring hybrid, could have made that hybrid, but they didn't. They decided that it was a much better idea to keep it lightweight. All-wheel drive was a necessity, but just build something that's fun to drive. And you could feel there was a lot of sense of pride and passion from the Toyota guys when they were presenting the car, because I think it's the first proper sports car that Toyota has made by itself for decades. Like, you know, the 86 and the Supra are not really made by Toyota. You know, they're made by Subaru and BMW respectively. But this car is a 100% Toyota. And that's the first time for a very, very long time that they've made a sports car. So, and it's a pretty good one.
that Japanese mentality of, you know, saving face and having pride and putting that above all things has really paid dividends here, I think, because like you say, Bors, you know, they could have just done a Polo GDI with this car and made it a bit punchier and a bit sportier. But, you know, this is on another level to any of the equivalently sized hot hatches out there. There's no comparison. You know, the depth of engineering that's been put into what is a niche vehicle that will only sell in small numbers in the grand scheme of things is unbelievable. And in this age where we've seen brands stop spending money on anything that isn't, you know, EV, it's frankly a remarkable car. And I think sometimes we don't stop to appreciate just how, you know, remarkable it is that Toyota actually bothered to make it at all.
Head to carexpert.com.au because this week Paul Marek's done a drag race between the GR Yaris and the Toyota Supra, which he actually owns. Go and check it out. It's well worth a watch. All right, it's time for news time, and we'll start off with you, Mike. Hyundai's pure electric platform, the EGMP, has just been revealed.
It has, yeah, and this really is the basis of Hyundai's electric future, Mandy. So we know that the company's already pretty big in the EV space with Ioniq and Kona, but this is sort of the next evolution of its electrification strategy. EGMP stands for Electric Global Modular Platform, and it's going to underpin everything from sedans to high-riding crossovers and SUVs. Not commercial vehicles, which is another kettle of fish, but pretty much everything else. It's going to begin with the Ioniq 5. As we know, Hyundai has spun off Ioniq into its own dedicated EV sub-brand and will also be used below numerous Kia products moving forward as well. Now, the top line figures are it's rear-wheel drive or dual-motor all-wheel drive, depending on the application, can handle up to 500 Ks of range, given the amount of space that it's made for the batteries, and supports motors that will propel it to 100 in less than 3.5 seconds in certain applications. So we know the Ioniq 5 SUV comes first, then the Ioniq 6, which is a sedan based on that gorgeous Prophecy concept that we saw recently, and then an Ioniq 7 large SUV completes the initial trio. All up, Hyundai plans to introduce 23 battery electric cars and sell a million, I should say, per annum from 2025. Now, just like the Porsche Taycan, the EGMP platform makes use of an 800-volt architecture that allows ultra-rapid charging at up to 350 kilowatts, which means you can pump the batteries up to 80% from zero in just under 20 minutes or give yourself 100 Ks of range in about 5 minutes. So really future-proofing the tech as much as possible. Now, interestingly, Hyundai has also said that it's going to continue making EVs based on internal combustion cars at the lower end for the cheap entry-level EVs. This is really for the higher end. But, you know, this is on a scale equivalent to the Volkswagen MEB. When we talk about these giant multinationals making one sort of toolkit to apply across numerous EV segments. And this is the key to really driving down the cost of those Hyundai EVs. So within 4 or 5 years, this is going to be a major part of the company's strategy.
I bet at least maybe 5 years ago, we didn't think Hyundai would be this far ahead with the game, did we?
Possibly not. And, you know, Hyundai's also put a ton of money into hydrogen fuel cells with the Nexo, and it's got trucks running on hydrogen fuel cells. Obviously, it's more at the heavy end of the market that that kind of technology theoretically makes more sense. But, you know, the company isn't backwards in going forwards. Just like General Motors and Volkswagen, it's really basically put all its eggs in the EV basket moving forward. And, you know, within 5 or 6 years, you're going to see the majority of that car's offerings, at least in Europe and America, being electrified.
Mm.
Yeah. Does that really excite you, Mike? Like, saying all of that really make
it excites me in a sense for the majority of buyers, Bors. The majority of people that aren't in love with cars quite like we are, I think it's actually a good thing for the planet. I think the scope for niche combustion engine vehicles that have more enthusiast bent is all right.
I was surprised that you were saying that new platform is more for the high-end stuff. I would have thought that that platform would actually reduce the cost of EVs, not necessarily create more expensive ones, while the normal ones are the cheaper ones that are based
on... It can kind of do both, really, because it's reducing the cost of what they would have otherwise been. So it's making premium products more affordable. But it does seem like the real entry-level ones are going to be, you know, using cheaper and different, maybe older technologies. I think because this is kind of the home of all of its newer technologies, it has to be amortized. And so they're going to put it under their premium products first. Although I'd say it's pretty likely that in time it'll trickle down to cheaper cars as well.
All right, we're going to move on now to some EV news. For anyone who has an EV, no doubt there is nothing more frustrating than seeing a non-EV parked in a charging station car park. But from now on, if you're one of those cheeky buggers who take those parks, you'll get fined $330.44 if you're based in Victoria. This fine also applies to EVs that are parked there but are not using the charging station. Colorado in the US has used similar rules to this to stop what is known as icing. And like, while this new fine seems to be helping Victorian EV drivers, the government is doing anything but in other areas, as we've discussed in previous podcasts in detail about that EV levy. Bors, I think nearly every one of the car expert team have said their opinion on this EV levy, but we haven't heard yours. I'd be keen to hear what you think of it.
Oh, having Mike on at the same time, I suspect that we're going to run out of time to discuss this, or it's going to get out of hand if I was to voice my opinion. But in regards to the parking issue, it's interesting that they're even going to fine EVs that aren't charging. Now, does that mean if you just stick the plug in and walk away, even though it's not fully, like, you know what I mean? Like, at what point are they going to check it? Because I imagine a lot of those EVs, even when they don't want to pay for charging or don't even need a charge, are still using those spaces, and that's annoying people. But are they just going to now, you know, put the plug in and walk away and say, oh, I didn't realize it was charging? Like, you know what? Yeah, that's going to be a bit of a gray area there. I have no issues with people getting fined for parking there when they don't even have an EV. So I think that's fair. But as long as they don't start expanding the number of them at shopping centres, you know, they're going to be the new disability park where they're basically most of the time completely empty. There's a few around my area, and tell you what, the EV parks are, there's never an EV in them. So I'm always curious as to who's actually using them. But in regards to the EV tax, yeah, I can see both sides of the argument. I completely agree that as more and more people buy EVs, it is unfair to tax people that don't have an EV for doing the same thing as people that do have an EV. I feel like that is a strange position. But at the same time, if you're trying to encourage the uptake of electric vehicles, then taxing them isn't really the right way to go about it. I mean, you can see what happened in California when they provided massive incentives. It's the reason that state has such enormous uptake of EVs. And that's gone now. Those incentives are gone. But it really kickstarted the whole concept. In fact, more than just in California, it sort of kickstarted globally just by them doing it. So it had a huge impact on EVs and EV sales and global companies putting in money for EVs. So we clearly don't have that mentality in Australia. But like Mike correctly pointed out in one of his articles recently, whether you agree with it or you don't agree with it, it's ridiculous that states get to set this state by state, because, you know, it's really bizarre that, you know, in Queensland I don't have that rule, but you guys will have it in Victoria, and some people in the ACT get a benefit by buying it. So it's just bizarre. I don't understand how that makes any sense.
Yeah, I think the overarching, you know, consensus in the industry, and I actually share this, is yes, I am a progressive person politically, but I don't necessarily think that the taxpayers should be incentivizing EVs necessarily. I'm not necessarily saying that we should have some $10,000 tax break to buy an EV, but the idea of actually disincentivizing EVs is the bit that's the problem. At least be technologically neutral at worst. Like, going out of your way to make them less desirable when you've got your own CO2 target set does seem a little bit counterintuitive to me.
But I mean, the argument of that is that they're just making them the same as a normal car in regards to what a normal person would pay by having paid for fuel. Now, that doesn't take into consideration, though, you know, the fact that these people are paying for electricity or paying for charging as well.
And the fact that the cars are more expensive, so they're paying more GST at the beginning of the process as well. But look, at the end of the day, it's a controversial issue. I spoke to Volkswagen boss Michael Bartsch this week, who said it was a bunch of parochial state treasurers, end quote, sticking their noses into places that they probably shouldn't be, which is quite interesting. And I think I tend to agree with him. It's a bit of political argy-bargy between the states and the feds. And until we have a cohesive national federal plan around EVs one way or another, you're going to find these wildly and often diametrically opposed directions taken by the states. And it's just going to end up with people bloody confused.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, a great way to do it would be to remove the luxury car tax, which would really
help.
At least remove it on EVs, and then you know that. Then I think you're going to find that whatever that little $300-$400 a year is well and truly going to be acceptable when you don't have to pay LCT on a luxury car. And some of those EVs that are in the luxury car bracket really aren't luxury cars, so it's getting a little bit out of hand. You could even potentially increase the threshold for LCT for EVs to a higher price, but none of this is ever going to happen. So I don't think any tax ever come in is going to leave. So we're going to just be stuck.
It's pretty hard for a politician to give up a nice source of income, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't know. Your premier did it in Victoria for quite some time.
Don't get Mike Costello started.
don't get Albor's Falas started. Anyhow.
Mike, the 2021 Isuzu D-Max, it has been a pretty popular ute, and the factory has reopened, but there's still some ongoing supply delays.
There are. So there's a statement here that says, we can confirm the all-new D-Max production for the Australian market is operational. However, there continues to be ongoing supply delays, specifically for this market due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Therefore, we will unfortunately be unable to fully meet the unprecedented levels of vehicle demand presently. Now, we've seen waiting lists of, you know, 6 months or more being spoken about. I've spoken to a few Isuzu dealers that have told me the wait list is potentially even longer than that on the top of the range X-Terrain. And we know that that's pretty keenly priced, $59,000 drive away for a fully loaded pickup. And, you know, this is really going to hurt Isuzu because, you know, the company's only got two models. It put a hell of a lot of effort into launching this new D-Max. It was one of the most hyped vehicles of the year, and deservedly so, because it is a very, very good ute. In my opinion, the equal class leader alongside its BT50 twin under the skin. And so to be able to come out and say, we've got this amazing new product, oh, but bugger, we don't have enough to sell, and you have to wait 6 months if you want one, that's really undermining all of the work that the company's done. It's not Isuzu Australia's fault. It's caught up in bigger global issues, but it's really going to hurt it, you know. I'm hoping for its sake that the supply eases up. But the big winners out of this are going to be Ford and Toyota, because if the Ranger and Hilux don't have supply shortages like D-Max does, a heap of people are going to say, stuff it, I'm not going to wait for my new pickup, I'm going to buy something else, and understandably so. So let's hope that Isuzu can rectify this quick smart.
Well, I mean, supply issues at the moment are pretty standard across the industry, but I think Mike's right. Not many people are willing to wait that long for a car. But I don't know. I mean, a lot of people are also, don't you think, Mike? I think if you want the right car, there's a human psychological element where if you can't have something, you probably want it even more.
I think yes, but I think when it comes to work vehicles, and let's be honest, a lot of pickups are bought because they're tax dodgers. They're good work vehicles that you can write off. Sometimes you can't wait that long. You know, sometimes your business purposes won't allow it. I think if it's a personal car, if it's your pride and joy that you're going to have as your own, you know, private vehicle, yes. But if it's for a work or a company order, and, you know, the X-Terrains are more private market focused, but if it's a business, forget about it. They're not waiting that long. So it's going to hurt.
And lastly, just a few hours ago, November new car sales figures, the VFACTS have lobbed, which is great timing for you, Mike.
How
did last month fare?
Well, hallelujah, Mandy. After 31 successive months of negative sales relative to the corresponding month in the previous year, the market has actually grown in November 2020, up just over 12%. So first time in almost 3 years that there have been more cars sold in a month than the corresponding month in the previous year. So a long time coming for the industry. Obviously, we saw some green shoots last month. The post-COVID spike, as it's being called, is certainly happening to some degrees where supply permits, because obviously a lot of people put off their purchases, particularly in New South Wales and Victoria, but across the nation as well. But then there are other things like, you know, JobKeeper, putting money back into the economy, further reforms to the finance sectors, pent-up demand, all these things mean that the market has gone up. So New South Wales is up 13%, Victoria up 9%, Queensland, Albors, where you are, up almost 20% for the month. So really good news from the top three states. Now, cumulatively, year-to-date sales, with only 1 month to go in the year, are still down 16%, just over 820,000 sales for the year so far. So there's no way we're hitting the magic million mark that we've become used to, but at least the recovery is come before the end of the year. Toyota was far and away the number one brand, as always, 23,000 sales. But not just that, it actually grew its sales by 37% and grew its market share to more than 24%. And four of the top five selling models in the market were Toyotas. So, you know, it was an absolute domination from Toyota. Mazda had a ripping month in second place, up 47% to just over 9,000 vehicles. Hyundai rounded out the podium, growing by 1.2%. Now, some other brands that grew more than the market average include Isuzu Ute, which was up 36% despite those D-Max shortages we mentioned. What could have been if it had cars on the ground? BMW up a whopping 53%. So that company is killing it this year. Now, Mercedes did still beat it for the month, but BMW on an absolute warpath at the moment. MG, China's MG, up 130%, situated 14th on the charts. Audi was up 13%. LDV, another Chinese brand, up 130% with its utes and vans. Lexus up 18%. Volvo up 28%. And Jeep, this is a really interesting story. Jeep was on an absolute, you know, decimating decline for a long time after the heights of 2015. It's finally going back up again, up 88% for the month. Some positive changes to that company in the back end with its warranties and after sales and things
like that.
That's
got to be
paying dividends.
Gladiator, though, shouldn't it? That would be solely on the Gladiator's back.
Gladiator only managed about 100 units, mate. So not just on Gladiator. The company seems to be really returning to that marketing strategy that was so good for it years ago. It's running good TVCs again. It's actually got a decent warranty to put itself, you know, put behind its products now. I think, you know, the company kind of started plumbing the depths and it looks like it's starting to sort of bounce a little bit. Gladiator helps, but obviously new Wrangler is also still quite early in its life cycle. And then, you know, Compass and Grand Cherokee don't really do as well as they perhaps should, but they're not struggling as much as they were at one stage either. So really interesting there. Porsche was up 46% and Havel was up 123%. Now, just in case you were listening to that closely, you would have noticed that that's three Chinese brands inside the top 25. So sales of China-made cars skyrocketed 135% in November, and they're up 60% year-to-date. That comes in context of a growing diplomatic row between little old Australia and China, and there's obviously pressure on in Australia to maybe think twice about buying Chinese products from some quarters. So I found that one quite interesting. Now, brands that went in the other direction and actually struggled for the month included Alfa Romeo, down 43%, Jag, down 42%, Ram Trucks, down 26%, Honda, down 24% as that company continues to contract, and Land Rover was down 11% as well. So for most brands, it does seem like the light that's been sort of hovering at the end of the tunnel has finally arrived. All the states in Australia except Tasmania are now well and truly up on what they were in the same month last year, and positive signs for 2021 await.
Did you mention the top models, or was I not listening properly?
Top models were Toyota Hilux number one, Ranger 2, RAV4 3, Corolla 4, Prado 5. So as I said, four of the top five cars were Toyotas. Rounding out the top 10, Mazda CX-5, Isuzu D-Max. And again, still finished in seventh place despite those supply shortages. Hyundai i30 in 8th, Hyundai Tucson in 9th, and the Toyota Land Cruiser Wagon outright 10th with just under 2,000 sales. That's on top of 2,600 Prado sales. Nissan had its all-time record month for the Y62 Patrol V8. I think there's this real understanding now that with international travel, you know, we're not going to be traveling overseas next year in all likelihood, but domestic travel's up and about now. I think a lot of people are investing in 4x4s, caravans, you know, the vehicles are going to allow them to have their great Aussie adventure, because those adventurous cars, that Ford Everest had an absolute record month as well. The list kind of goes on. So, you know, if I was selling big 4x4 SUVs at the moment, I'd be rubbing my hands together with glee, because I think sales of those are going to kill it for the next few months.
Yes, I wonder what the sales of motorhomes and caravans are at the moment. I know we don't have access to those details, well, but it'd be interesting, wouldn't it?
I bought some shares in Apollo Campers recently with that in mind. And, yeah, I think there's a real understanding that motorhome business, the caravan business, and let's not forget, there are a ton of Aussie companies making caravans. I mean, this is going to be there's going to be a glut of those vehicles in a couple of years' time once everybody's kind of done their travel. But I think, yes, you know, now that people can't go to Europe for the holiday, you know, that they're going to look at things like that. So, yeah, I think it's a real bit of the market to watch.
Yeah. You can read the full VFAX report now and the rest of the car news up at carexpert.com.au. James Wong, good day to you.
Hello. How are you?
Very good. Now, last week you spoke about how the local arm of Alfa Romeo is keen to bring the mad Giulia GTA to Australia, which we nodded our head in approval with a very big cheeky grin.
Yeah.
Jo, you've spent some time behind the wheel of the Alfa Romeo Giulia, which has seen a bit of an upgrade and a price rise. So what's new in the 2020 Giulia?
So across the range, they actually haven't had really price rises are probably a strong term. They've sort of revised the pricing and spec structure. So, for example, while the entry price is a little bit higher than the old one, they've sort of combined the options packages that were available on the pre-update and added in some more luxury and tech features so that it's a little bit more better value. So that's the main part of it. So it's a bit more techie. There's more driver assist stuff. There's a new infotainment system, but the overall look and feel of it is still very similar. So we just had a launch of it. I drove the base model, which is now called the Giulia Sport. So it used to be Giulia, Giulia Super, Giulia Veloce, and Giulia QV or Quadrifoglio, or however you want to say it. I'm sure Crawf will teach me how to pronounce it properly in Italian. But yeah, so I had the updated 2021 Alfa Romeo Giulia Sport, which is the new entry point. Now they've given them all a really sporty look. So before, you used to have to option a package to kind of get the five hole wheels, which is a very iconic Alfa Romeo design, and, you know, the low profile tires and all that. But now that's all standard. So you get sport seats wrapped in leather. You get these cool, I love the wheels on this thing. It's got red brake calipers, and the entry level model still is a 2-liter turbocharged petrol. But it's 147 kilowatts. So it's sort of the same level of performance that you might get from like a hot hatch, like a Golf GTI. I can do like a mid 6 second 0 to 100. So it's still quite a sporty thing. And now that it's better value, they're really trying to, I think, appeal to a wider buyer set, because obviously in that medium sedan luxury segment, you know, your 3 Series and your C-Class is quite a standard choice. And, you know, BMW is a little bit more sporty, whereas the Merc might be a little bit more luxurious. So this one's sort of more on the sportier side of things, but now they're trying to add extra value to it.
What sort of extra things have they added in, like in terms of the tech that you were talking about earlier?
Yeah, so there's a new infotainment system. So it's now touchscreen as well as operated by the clicky wheel. I don't even know what the correct terminology is for that thing. But yeah, so they've got, it's a new interface. So it's got touchscreen. It's much nicer. It's got Apple CarPlay and Android Auto. And then it's a much more substantial driver assistance suite. So now you've got like semi-autonomous driving systems. They call it Highway Assist, which combines adaptive cruise control with stop and go, as well as lane keep assist. So that was a feature that was previously not there. There's also driver attention monitoring. You've got, what else have we got here? Auto high beam, active blind spot assist, traffic sign recognition, and driver attention monitoring. So it's a lot more competitive with a lot of the standard luxury sedan players in terms of tech now. And it also gets all this stuff as standard across the range. So you might find with some of its rivals that you have to maybe tick an option box here and there to get the full, you know, semi-autonomous driver stuff. But here it's all standard, which is a really good move, I think, because, you know, we like to think that safety and all that stuff shouldn't be optional. And here they've gone all out with all that tech. So you've got all of that stuff right from the base model.
I really want this Alfa to be amazing. I've always wanted Alfa to be a strong brand. But in all honesty, tell me if you agree with this, Wongi, but, you know, the only Giulia that really, you know, screams out, buy me, buy me, buy me, is the Quadrifoglio with that ridiculous Ferrari-developed twin-turbo six-banger engine that is just biblically good in terms of its sound and its speed. Does the rest of it really do enough to stand out compared to the likes of the 3 Series and the C-Class and the A4 and the S60 and the XE and this endless list of brilliant competitors? Yes, we know the Quadrifoglio is spectacular, but I don't know, the others were always sort of middling prospects to me, and it doesn't sound like this update has really moved the dial all that much.
Yeah, it's an interesting way to look at it, because that's sort of how I went into this thinking. I was like, well, if it's not the Quadrifoglio, it's probably not worth it or whatever. But like, I think between the three models, obviously the Quadrifoglio is about $140,000. It's a little bit cheaper than before, but it's still a very expensive car for most people. So this $63,000 or $64,000 base model, I feel, is a really good value buy, purely because you get all of the features and stuff, and it benefits from all the updates. But the bare bones of it are still great, and it's always been great. I've always loved the Giulia. It's always been like the driver's pick for me personally, in that segment, purely because everything just feels right, and the car sort of shrinks around you, and it's still got that really sporty, engaged feel. And I think where sometimes maybe the Veloce and the QV sort of fall down a little bit is that the cabin sometimes may not be as grand and luxurious as you might get from some of the German brands. And you know, you think of Italian cars, and you see what some of the really high-end boutique Italian brands do with like the Italian leathers and the really out there design and stuff, and the Alfa is still very conventional from the cabin. So you get this gorgeous exterior, which I think is also another standout feature of it. It just looks incredible, and it didn't really need any changes with this update, and it didn't really get any. So not that that's a bad thing, because it still looks fantastic. It's just that sometimes I just feel like the cabin is more, it's functional, it's pretty ergonomically good. Like they've made a few changes to the center console and like the front center armrest cubby to sort of accommodate your phone better, and you know, you've got a little slot for your key, and everything sort of just fits really nicely. I just feel like Moko said, it's just not quite there in terms of you know, ambience and that sort of luxurious feel that you might get from one of the established German brand. So, but what this car does do is that for an entry-level product, it really gives you a sharp, engaging, fun driving experience. And, you know, this car, you know, has a 2-liter turbo engine with 147 kilowatts. And, you know, on paper, that might not look like a lot. But compared to all the base level rivals, it's got more power. It can do 0 to 100 as quickly as a Golf GTI. And it just puts a smile on your face when you find a twisty back road. The steering is so direct and so quick that you just feel like it's a much smaller car. It feels like a sports car to drive. It's got a little burbly engine, though. It gets off the line nice and quick. And it's one thing that they've managed to do really well with this platform is engineer it so that it's not only fun to drive, but also super refined on the open road. So you can drive it. This car's on 19-inch wheels with low-profile Pirelli P0 tires, but it's still very refined on even on coarse chip roads. It's never upset too much by the lumps and bumps in the road. This one had optional adaptive suspension, which no doubt helped a little bit, but it rode beautifully, it handles beautifully, and it's also impressively well suppressed from road and wind noise. So it drives and feels like a luxury car, you know, through the steering wheel and through the seat. It's just some of the trimmings and materials, in my opinion, probably could have used a little bit more work. In some of the higher models, especially like the Quadrifoglio, you get these beautiful leather-lined, you know, dash and door tops with a really smooth finish with contrasting stitching and stuff. And I just wish that they even offered that as an option on a base car, so you could just really dress it up a little bit, because in some places you can sort of tell that it might be related to other products, because even though the platform's bespoke to Alfa Romeo, some of the parts like the infotainment or the controls or the switch gear might be found elsewhere in the Fiat Chrysler group. So just a little bit more differentiation would be nice, but it's still a great car.
Well, I had a similar question to Mike in regards to, you know, I do love the car. I definitely love the QV, but if I was in that segment, I would find it really hard to consider that as a viable option against the 3 Series or even the C-Class, even though C-Class is quite old. But you get into that new 3 Series and the tech in that car feels like it's 2 generations ahead of the Giulia and even the updated facelift. So I don't know. I feel like they need to be really sharp on the price to move that car. So for me, it's a tough sell, but it could just be me.
No, I agree. And one of the ways that I ended my review was saying that, you know, this car is, as much as Alfa Romeo is trying to appeal to a wider audience, it appeals still to a very specific buyer. And, you know, the kind of person that actually buys a Giulia is very different to, say, a 3 Series or a C-Class buyer, even a Jaguar XE buyer, because they're in there for a very specific product. They might not be really keen on all the big screens and all the extra tech that you might get from a German car, but they want that really sexy design. They want analog dials. They want a really sporty feeling car. And it just appeals to a very certain type of person. So I think it still serves that role very well. And I think that it will continue to appeal to its current demographic. I just think that if they're trying to widen the scope a little bit, it's still not quite there. Yeah. But I think it's still fundamentally a wonderful car. And if anybody wants something a little bit different that drives really well, I would certainly recommend taking it for a test drive.
And you can't beat those sexy Italian lines either. It's a gorgeous car. That review of the Alfa Romeo Giulia is now up at carexpert.com.au. James Wong, thank you.
Thank you.
Mike, this week you went to a Volkswagen event of the year that was and the year that's going to come up in 2021, and you got a chance to sit down with the Volkswagen Australia boss, Michael Bartsch. What sort of things did you have a chinwag over?
Yeah, look, every time you get a chance to speak to Michael, it's always worthwhile. He's never backwards in coming forwards. He's always happy to sort of, you know, share his thoughts on the industry. So we spoke about a couple of pressing Volkswagen issues, the next generation Amarok, which we know is going to be spun off the Ford Ranger, this silly state-based mileage tax for electric vehicles and his fairly strong oppositional opinions certainly came up. And also spoke a little bit about the servicing side of the business. We know Volkswagen had some dramas for a while there with, you know, keeping its customers satisfied once they'd bought a car. And the company's been doing a lot of work to try and improve its reputation in customer satisfaction surveys. So that kind of stuff is a bit dry, but we covered that off as well. So it's a good listen. So stick around and hear what he has to say.
Can you talk us through the situation regarding electric vehicles for Volkswagen in Australia, ID3, ID4? What's the rollout prospect for our market looking like at the moment?
Well, at the moment it's a little unclear. It's not a case of not getting the vehicle. We just don't know exactly yet when. We're expecting it to be somewhere around the end of 2023. Why I'm sounding a little vague is simply because the product planning hasn't been done for Australia, because the first focus is to get the car in the Northern Hemisphere. The imperative for electric vehicles there is much higher than it is here in Australia because of the legislative environment. It's a supply issue, and the factories and the brand and that have to get the sufficient units into the market up there to avoid getting the penalties against CO2 output, the quotas that they need to achieve there. And so long as there's no government regime here in Australia that focuses on something similar, well, there's not a whole lot of imperative or focus to get drive to get the vehicles here.
Well, it's not only that the government isn't incentivising it. In some states, the government's actually disincentivising EVs.
That makes no sense. It simply makes no sense.
And just for the benefit of the listeners, we're talking here about the proposed mileage charges that are being introduced in Victoria and South Australia. Clearly, you're not a fan?
No, I think it's crazy. I mean, it really is. You know, we've always said we don't expect incentives. We don't expect anyone to pay for bringing, for products coming to market. And incentives invariably create distortions. But certainly we're absolutely against disincentives. And it simply doesn't make sense when, on one hand, we're talking about the imperative of addressing the issues of global warming, but before the products even hit the market, and before they even have a chance of getting a foothold. They're at very parochial state levels, very parochial state treasurers are deciding that we should tax it. And when you think about what, you know, the ramp-up curve on electric vehicles will be over, say, 5 years, and what that represents as a total percentage of vehicles on the road, it's just craziness. It's small-mindedness to say that you would tax that. Well and truly before the thing's even got its fingers on the ledge here in Australia, it doesn't make sense.
Just to pivot, I remember when you first joined Volkswagen Australia, you spoke a lot about needing to improve customer satisfaction on the service side of the business. Mm. You talked today about a lot of the things that you've done, prepaid service packages on old vehicles, on new vehicles, express servicing, warranty extensions, things of that nature. How have you progressed in a more macro sense in terms of customer satisfaction, in terms of offering the servicing that's required of your brand? Have you made the strides that you wanted to? Mm. And is there still some work to be done, or are you happy with where the perceptions are at now?
Look, one's never happy. You never stand still in this business because it's a moving target. You know, as we move ahead, then so does the competition. It's the nature of the business. I think when we look at our sales over the last couple of years, our market share, the price positions that we currently command, the repeat business, and even in the simple surveys that we're doing internally, we've lifted satisfaction significantly, and I think the general take of the product speak for themselves. Yeah. The interesting thing, I was also saying, if you have a look at this environment that we've been operating in with coronavirus, every cloud has a silver lining, and I think one of the really, really interesting byproducts of it has been that the business has understood how important it is to service existing customer base as a core of maintaining business, of driving business. And that in itself has created an impetus that even the best laid plans couldn't have achieved. So we're starting to see even there increments of focus and improvement. So overall, very happy with the way that the business has gone.
And just the final one, Australia is the number two Amarok market in the world,
yep.
Number one for V6, I believe, so the profit driver. Mm. We've just had a hint from your commercial guys talking about the 2023 next gen, which is obviously being developed alongside Ford, with Ford as the senior partner. You said before that you're going to try and add a little bit of Volkswagen flavour to the next Amarok, so it's not just a badge engineered car. And you mentioned about not necessarily making the same mistakes Mercedes did with its X-Class and how close that was to the Navara. Mm. Can you just expand a bit on that, I guess, within the confines of what you can say around what we can expect from the next iteration of Amarok?
Well, look, I think it goes back to the starting point of when this alliance was formed. The joint project was formed between Ford and Volkswagen. There were certainly lessons to be learned from the Mercedes and the Nissan Navara experience, and that was used as an example of the importance of making sure that things weren't just badge engineered, that you had to have substance. And in our case, whatever product is developed, it has to be distinctly Ford and it has to be distinctly Volkswagen. And that was a very understood premise of the project. And as a consequence of that, I'm absolutely confident that what you'll see are two products with two very specific, very distinct characters. One will attract the Ford buyer and one will attract the Volkswagen buyer, and it will be successful.
Can you push the parochial angle with new Amarok in the sense that Range is obviously an Australian project led R&D in Australia, which would make the Amarok by extension the most Aussie-fied of all Volkswagens?
Yeah, I think one of the things that is universally recognised is that we have some of the toughest operating environments in the world. You take the car out through Simpson Desert and you take them on the Telegraph track, and you know, we've had so many stories with journalists, and those stories resonate over in Hannover and Wolfsburg, it's very clear that if a car makes it in Australia, then it'll make it generally in wherever else it ends up in the world. So that ability to deliver a product tested and developed in Australia, I think in itself will be an extremely strong marketing platform. They understand the value of that, and while we don't have the whole new anymore, we'll certainly have the Volkswagen Amarok to fill its place.
Michael Bartsch, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We're joined by Anastasia Lloyd-Wallace from the Retail Doctor Group, which specialises in market insights for retailers, both physical and online. Anastasia's here to talk about the development of online car sales and how the pandemic is changing that as well. So Anastasia, thanks for taking the time.
Nice to be here.
I suppose to start with and away from cars, can you talk more broadly about how online shopping has grown over the past 5 or 10 years? Because obviously it's a fairly new development, but it's also massive.
Definitely. So we've been seeing that the slow growth of online over the last few years, and consumers moving, and you know, in particular our digital natives, our millennials, our Gen Z, moving to purchase certain products. And pre-COVID, we were on average around 9% in Australia, and retail as a whole was done online. In the last 6 months, we've seen a massive accelerant. So COVID really has brought it forward. So we're now seeing about an average of 15%. But what's been interesting is we've now seen it across the board in all sectors. So what was purely, you know, fashion, maybe accessories, we're seeing a huge rise in groceries, the grocery shopping online, right the way through to furniture shopping, home. Anything to do with the home is booming through online at the moment. And we're really seeing a shift in consumer behavior. So we've noted what was traditionally for the younger demographics. We're seeing our boomers and older embracing this online technology. So we've seen retailers really adapt their online offering. So it really is quite rounded now.
And do you expect that change to reverse a little bit after the pandemic, or is it very much a case of now people are doing this, that's the habit you expect them to keep?
Yeah, so I think what we're seeing, and I talk a lot about, there's a growing divide between sort of convenience and experiential retail, so to speak. So effectively, what's transactional and what's the experience? So I think there's still a large place for the physical store. And that will never go away because we're all social beings. We like to interact. We like to experience products, touch, feel, smell. But it's how it all kind of interacts together now. So a great example is click and collect. You know, you order online and then you pick it up in the store. So combining that physical and online experience. And I think that's what we're going to see moving forward. I think click and collect is without a doubt here to stay because it really works in this transactional retail area. And I think we will keep in certain categories seeing the rise of online. I mean, Amazon kind of are leading the way overseas and in the last 2 years have really kind of moved consumer mindset to understand that they can get these products online, and in particular products that are transactional. We can get our toilet roll ordered online without having to think about it.
Very pertinent one for 2020.
Yeah.
So Volkswagen is among a whole lot of car makers that have launched their online sales portals this year during COVID. It says it sold 460 cars online for a total of $36 million in new car sales. Although that's a big number, dollar number, it's also quite a small percentage of the number of cars it's sold. But there's a really high transaction price there compared to buying even big ticket furniture items online. So how have we hit a point where people are comfortable spending an average of just under $80,000 in the case of Volkswagen on a car without necessarily actually getting to touch it, feel it, smell it in a showroom, and, you know, without getting to haggle with a salesperson?
Yeah, it really is sort of big leaps and bounds forwards. And I think what we've seen is that brands are building this trust online. And they're doing this by creating, I like to use the word, a frictionless experience. So they're making it easy for people to interact online and then building that trust. And then what we've seen with Volkswagen is the launch of their augmented reality. So customers can now touch the product, see the product, almost have that full experience through the digital portal. You know, we know everyone is spending on average 4 hours a day on their smartphone. So they're really digitally savvy. Even, you know, all demographics, again, using these smartphones. So it's this comfort that they're using, looking at it through a product that they're very familiar with. And they then trust this brand, this retailer. And we've seen it move up through the different sectors. So I suppose effectively it started in the low value. So we saw the use of augmented reality in the beauty where you're trying your lipstick. And then it moved into the higher purchase of the fashion. And then it kind of moved into luxury fashion. So you can try on your Gucci sneakers through Snapchat without actually having to even try them on your feet and purchase them. And then we kind of, it's now moving, like we said, into furniture, so higher value, and then into high-end jewelry, and then now into cars. So I think it's this build-up of trust. And it's these technologies that are now available that are helping consumers gain that trust because they can really experience the products.
What does it say about the traditional dealership model for selling cars if people are more comfortable buying online or trust what's being given to them by a manufacturer directly online instead of going into a showroom and kicking the tires, which was once the case? Because a lot of brands are now moving to have these AR apps. I know Porsche and Volkswagen are two of the big ones. It's something we're expecting to see grow, obviously.
Yeah, I think what I see in the future is it's this combination of the physical and the digital. And I think all consumers are very different. So I talk a lot, I won't go into the nerdiness today, but a lot about consumer personality profiling. So we all have different personality types and each consumer is looking for a very different thing from their retailer. And so there's always going to be those traditional consumers that do want to go into the physical store. And then there's going to be those that are very much happy at the other end of the spectrum to do every aspect, make it as easy as possible. They don't want to talk to anybody and do it all online. And then sort of all varieties in between. I think where we're going to almost level out is this, we can view all the products, we can make our decisions online, and then we might still purchase in the physical showroom. So I think there is going to be very much a hybrid approach going forward. I mean, what we're seeing at the moment is consumers are very much more educated. They're using that the digital platforms to really pre-research before they make any purchases. So what we're seeing with this augmented reality and this moving online for the car industry is that it's giving consumers that ability to research and educate themselves prior to even coming into the physical store. But I think there'll still be a place for everything.
So along with diving into everything we're publishing on Car Expert, which is the first thing we would say to anyone who wants to buy a car, are there any other tips you have for people who might be looking to buy a car online? Because it's obviously a very different process.
That's it. I think it is very much the consumer is in control now. So, it's what do you feel comfortable with and what platforms are you wanting to utilize? Because now there is so much choice out there, as in how do you want to pre-research? What options do you want to look at? Looking for whether it's reviews or whether it's the use of augmented reality. And I think this really comes back down to the individual consumer. One of the consumer trends that I often talk about is personalization. And that's not just in the products. I'm talking about personalization of how you purchase. So there's always aspects so you can purchase in the way that you want. So I think that's probably what's key for the consumers is there's a method out there that really will suit your needs.
And I think to wrap this up, as the way that people buy cars does change, what do you think needs to happen to the physical space where people have traditionally gone to do that? Because if a showroom is playing a different role in the purchase, laying it out like it has always been laid out doesn't make a whole lot of sense from my end.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think this really moves into this experiential part and a lifestyle almost. So the showroom is playing that that end part, whether it's an area where you've purchased online and it's very much a quick transaction, you pick up and you leave. So there's almost a separate area. And we're seeing that in all aspects of retail now, specific areas set aside for the likes of a click and collect where, you've purchased online and you pick up. And then the complete opposite end of the spectrum where, it's all about the experience. So it's much more about how that car fits into your lifestyle. And it's rather than just having several cars, it's evoking those emotions. So creating this emotional experience in the showroom, because customers are really looking for when they leave the house, they really want it to be more of an experience. So I think that's really going to filter through to that car buying experience. If they're making the effort to set foot in the showroom, they want it to be special.
Perfect. Thank you very much for taking the time. And we really appreciate it.
No problems at all. Thanks for having me and great to chat.
That brings an end to this week's podcast. Alborz, I hear you've been spending some time behind the wheel of a Genesis G80. I know Will's had some good things to say about this car, but what are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's just been sitting at the Brisbane office, so I stole the keys from Will and took it for a drive, expecting it to be relatively ordinary, but I was genuinely shocked by how much I liked the inside of the car. I really like the way it looks. I really like the inside. It doesn't really drive like a sports car, but it's pretty comfortable, and that's fine. Like, I actually don't mind its driving characteristics. It's a bit lazy. It's a bit it leans into corners and stuff, but that's fine. It doesn't really bother me at all. But, yeah, the tech in that car is quite outstanding. And I don't know. For Genesis, I wasn't expecting it to be like that. I expect it to be a – I guess I've got a lot of PTSD from Infiniti, so I guess that's what I was sort of anticipating. A Hyundai with a different badge, but it's certainly not the case.
What about the steering wheel, Boz? It's the weirdest looking steering wheel of all time.
It is. It's a strange looking steering wheel. It really is. My biggest issue with that brand is still its pricing. I think it really needs to build its credibility before it can demand European prices for 10% less. I think it's got a while to go to get there. But if you could get that car for a good deal, which I know you can't because they won't discount, it's actually a tremendous buy. So much so that I've been looking to replace my F-Pace, and that GV80 is sort of – I'm shopping a GV80 against a Porsche Cayenne, if that even makes sense.
Wow.
Yeah, because nothing else in that category interests me. So those two cars are getting shortlisted for my wife to have a drive of at some point soon. But yeah, look, to even consider that is interesting. There's not even a Genesis dealer in Brisbane. so I don't know where I'd buy it from, but I'll work it out.
I feel like you'd probably find a way, Boz.
Well, I can't test drive one, so that's a problem. So I can't take my wife to a Genesis store to get her to test drive one because there isn't one. And also, as someone that loves to get a bargain, I'll be standing for 3 days at the store arguing with the guy to get a dollar off and he won't give it to me. And that's going to really annoy me and make me go and buy a Porsche. So it is what it is.
All right. Mike, what cars have we got in the garage next week?
Oh, we've got a heap of good metal, Mandy. We've got the down in Melbourne. We've got a end-of-the-line Audi RS3 Sportback, a updated Toyota Fortuner that I'm comparing against a Ford Everest. Got a little tiny city car twin test I'm doing with a Yaris versus a Kia Rio, a Ford Mustang high-performance fastback. Up in Sydney, we've got an Audi A8 sedan, an MG ZST. Looks like you guys up in Queensland have got the Audi SQ7, which in my experience is an absolute family express. And the launch scene is starting to pick up too. So I've had a couple of new model launches this week. And then next week it continues with the new, or I should probably say reskinned, because the mechanicals underneath are pretty much the same as far as I know, but the new Lexus IS sedan, which I have to say looks bloody good in terms of its design anyway. It looks $1 million. So I think a lot of brands are really starting to squeeze in their launches before the end of the year, and we're trying to drive as many cars as we can before we wrap things up over Chrissy. So plenty of good metal to keep an eye out for over the coming weeks.
Lovely. And if you have any feedback for us, if you've been listening to the podcast and you've got something to say, please email us podcast@carexpert.com.au. Alborz and Mike, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you, Mandy. Cheers, Borz.